You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone, and Merry Christmas. And for some reason, growing up in the 60s, I wanted a real fire truck for Christmas, and I wanted to sign up to be an astronaut. I thought that was a Christmas thing.
A real fire truck? You mean as in one from, like, the firehouse?
Parked out in front of our house, just in case, you know, something went wrong. That's what I wanted. What are your childhood
sure what to make
dreams,
about
wishes, and hey, wanted to be ready. Ready. Talking about your dreams, wishes, and desires, think back. What was the dream that you had as a child that never ended up under the tree, or what did come true? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
Now we're going to move on to a discussion with blogger Nate Silver, who made his name by using his skills as a baseball statistician to call the presidential race for Obama back in March. His site, 538.com, became the go-to spot for obsessive poll watchers during the election. Well, now he's done something really interesting, which is turn his attention to Congress and what numbers there can foretell about what's going to happen in 2009. And he joins us now. Welcome, Nate.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
So you have a couple of predictions. Let's start with the Senate. And you've taken a look at what Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid has done this year. What do you think it says about next year?
Well, it's going to be different, I think. I think, you know, governing when you don't really control the agenda because you don't have the White House is a different thing than when you do. And when Obama might have, you know, a half dozen key agenda items he wants to get done in the first 6 to 9 months. So it'll be an adjustment. I think they have to play a bit more offense. I think they're used to playing defense even when they had the majority. And so we'll see if kind of Harry Reid is up to the task to facilitating what Obama wants to do.
You've called him ineffective as majority leader. Can you explain that?
Well, one thing we looked at is the number of filibusters, or really the number of cloture votes. This is a motion to end debate and proceed to actually have an up or down vote. There were twice as many of those votes last year in the 110th Congress as there have been in a long time, twice as many as there were 2 years prior, for example. It doesn't necessarily mean he's ineffective, but that was my take on it, given that usually you want to extract some public pressure on the other side, so if they are obstructing legislation, people know about it. Or you're kind of giving them some carrots or some sticks, so you're compromising in some way. You know, the Congress got very little done last year in general. I would say the kind of culture of the Senate is maybe not as strong as and as bipartisan as it might have been in times past. And as a result, kind of no one wound up being happy.
Well, in the Lyndon Johnson era of the Senate, you had a lot more going on behind the scenes, it seemed to me. And so it would never come to a cloture vote because things were already sort of figured out. It's as though Harry Reid has just accepted the cloture vote as an arbiter here. And so that's why there's so many. And he doesn't have 60 votes, so he loses a lot.
Yeah, I mean, one argument I'm making, too, is that maybe he's almost too quick to use that cloture option. Instead of, you know, maybe you should string the Republicans out a little bit longer, force them to actually use the delay tactics on the floor and create a bit more of a kind of public spectacle. But we clearly are a long way away from the LBJ era. I mean, for one thing, both parties have gotten more polarized. The Democrats tend to be more liberal than they were, and Republicans more conservative. So it's kind of harder to find that middle ground. You don't kind of have these Southern Democrats like you used to, where it was kind of a de facto third party almost. But nevertheless, there's not so much cooperation, and I think people are always worried about things blowing up at any time. There's a lot of bad blood on both sides. You know, with the whole kind of nuclear option debate, I think, a couple of years ago, that also kind of put everyone's on the brink, really, of kind of blowing up at any time.
Explain to us how you're taking a look at the numbers and coming up with conclusions on how Congress is going to be working.
Well, one thing we want to look at is kind of where are people under pressure electorally, because I think congressional behavior is pretty predictable, really. You know, if you look at the bailout vote, for example, both the auto bailout and the bailout back in the summer, you know, for the financial bailout, people kind of in higher income districts were more inclined to support it, certainly, where you have more kind of an investor class of voter. People who were up for re-election were less inclined to support it. So that's kind of what we're looking at, is really is kind of demystifying all the behavior of Congress, because really, you know, these people have incentives. The biggest incentive most any congressman has is, number one, getting re-elected, but also kind of not getting yelled at. It's a question of, do I anger my constituents, the people who are giving me money, by doing this for my kind of fellow Democrats or fellow Republicans who are trying to kind of show how the sausage is made, so to speak.
And you're presuming that initially, at least, when the Congress sets out, that much of what the individual lawmakers decide to do is going to be tied to how popular Obama was in their state. Explain that.
Well, I think so. If we looked at the auto bailout bill, for example, there were 10 Republicans who voted actually for cloture on that bill. And they were, you know, I think 8 out of the 10 were from states that Obama won, states like Maine, which he won by 17 or 18 points, or Pennsylvania, or Ohio. You know, conversely, the 3 or 4 Democrats who voted against it were from red states that he had lost, states like Arkansas, Louisiana, where you have Democratic senators, but where Obama's not very popular. I mean, right now, Obama is the star of the show. As pessimistic as the country is right now, he should have 70 or so percent approval ratings beginning his term, which is the highest of any president starting his term since John F. Kennedy. As long as he's that popular, then people, you know, in states that he won by a large margin can't really afford to obstruct his agenda. But conversely, the minute he runs into problems, they could snowball where you do have, you know, say, Blanche Lincoln in Arkansas, a state he lost badly, who's up for re-election in 2010. She'll be looking maybe to defy him if he's no longer so popular nationally.
And that already succeeded in Georgia, where Saxby Chambliss already won a runoff election and used that explicitly as the campaign issue.
Yeah, I think the public's feeling is that, you know, we've given Obama and the Democrats enough ammunition. You know, whether they have 57 or 58 or 59 senators, depending on how Illinois and Minnesota are resolved, and, you know, with a large advantage in the House, you know, I think the public's feeling is, you know, we're not going to take any excuses for them not getting stuff done. I think it would behoove the administration to pursue an active agenda. I think almost trying and failing would almost look better in the public eye than being overly cautious.
That's some advice from Nate Silver. Nate Silver is a blogger for 538.com. Thank you.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing. Or
politics.
Country music.
Hockey.
Sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.